everybody. Hi there, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Whew, I'm anticipating a very exciting program, and I recommend all of us take a nice deep breath before we get started. My anxiety's up. How about yours? Every day, we learn about something new that's going on in the United States with our government that doesn't feel very good. We're going to be talking about a lot of different things today, connecting dots between one thing or another, and bringing it all back to my favorite subject, food. And I'm really excited because I finally talked to one of my favorite doctors and colleagues to take some time to talk to me. Dr. Milton Mills is on the program today. He practices urgent care medicine in the Washington, D.C. area and has served previously as Associate Director of Preventative Medicine and currently as a member of the National Advisory Board for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He has been a major contributor to position papers presented by PCRM to the United States Department of Agriculture regarding dietary guidelines for Americans and is the lead plaintiff in PCRM's class action lawsuit that asked for warning labels on milk. Dr. Mills earned his medical degree at Stanford University of Medicine and completed an internal medicine residency at Georgetown University Hospital. He has published several research journal articles dealing with racial bias in federal nutrition policy. He frequently donates his time via practicing at free medical clinics and travels widely speaking at hospitals, churches, and community centers throughout the country. And I just have to add that he is a super human being. Welcome, Milton. How are you?
I'm good, Karen. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm giving you a big virtual hug.
And I'm hugging you right back. It's so good to be
here. I like to say on this program that we tune in live and we tune in love.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the last time you were on this program was 5 years ago.
Wow. It's been that long. It doesn't seem that long.
We had a great conversation. I was reviewing the transcript before. A lot of people still access that program in the archives because I think they're looking for you, and I'm glad I have something to offer.
I feel like
we've been connected because I've been reading a lot of your posts on Facebook for the last, a little more than 100 days, I think.
Yeah, and I still haven't been picked up by the NSA, so.
That's very good. So I want to start first talking about you and your work, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit more about some of these big issues that seem to be changing on a daily basis.
Sure.
Now, you're working in critical care, the ICU?
That's right. That's right. In fact, I was at work last night, and, we had the usual types of cases that we see in the ICU, patients with poorly controlled diabetes who are in a serious metabolic state called diabetic ketoacidosis, which means that they have such severe metabolic derangements that if they aren't admitted to the intensive care unit, put on IV medications, they are in danger of literally dying from their disease. And, I saw people with blood infections, pneumonias, heart disease, the usual kinds of acute manifestations of chronic diseases that we often see in Western countries that, again, are most, in most cases, related to the way that we eat and live.
I mean, I can't imagine, you've been doing this for such a long time, how profoundly frustrated you must be knowing that most of these cases shouldn't be there. They're not necessary. Diabetes, preventable, reversible.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, heart disease. And even the patients who, for instance, I had a very unfortunate case last night of a gentleman who was in his mid-50s who died from a cancer, again, that was strongly linked to dietary and lifestyle factors and therefore potentially preventable. And I, you know, once again, I was speaking to his young son, who was in his 20s, and looking into this young man's eyes and having to deliver the news that your father's probably not going to make it through this, and seeing the hurt, seeing the pain, it's just heartbreaking.
It is, well, there's no pun intended there either. It is heartbreaking, and his heart was broken by
absolutely
his lifestyle, unfortunately. Okay, so 5 years ago, we talked about rethinking food and how people should look at their food differently, not necessarily that it tastes good, but are they being nourished from it? And I really enjoyed that conversation. Have you seen any changes in the last 5 years?
I mean, I have seen some changes, but certainly not nearly enough. I mean, again, sadly, as I was leaving the hospital this morning, I stopped by the cafeteria to just, you know, grab some things. And again, there were people in line buying the usual markers of the American standard diet, bacon, sausage, you know, eggs, and so forth. And I just, it was so ironic and just personally painful to be standing in a hospital watching people eating food that is essentially destroying their bodies. So, you know, there has been some change. Clearly, the knowledge and attention that's being paid to plant-based lifestyle and eating and the importance of changing one's diet is more widely known. There are more people who are changing their diets every day. It used to be that, you know, vegan is the word vegan was a strange word to people, whereas now you say vegan and people immediately know what you're talking about, and they don't think that you're from another country, let alone outer space. So yes, there have been positive changes, but again, not nearly enough. And I think a big part of that is because the traditional American and Western approach to food, as we spoke about last time, tends to look at food as a hedonistic experience, meaning that here's an opportunity to sort of indulge yourself and immerse yourself in some kind of gustatory pleasure, when, you know, there's no question that we want the act of eating to be pleasant, but the primary purpose of eating, again, as we discussed last time, is really to serve as a means of delivering important and necessary nutrients to our bodies. But that fact is often completely lost or certainly overshadowed by the idea that people just want to have a pleasurable experience and really not pay attention to whether or not they're actually getting, you know, the appropriate kinds of nutrients and enough of those nutrients.
All right, let's delve into some other topics. The Affordable Care Act came into play a few years ago.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And now our government is wanting to rewrite that into the Affordable Health Care Act.
Which
we
is
learned
a complete
so many things that, like, people didn't realize that Obamacare was the Affordable Health Care Act. All kind of crazy things. I personally feel that there was a large group of people who just didn't want a black man to have a legacy, and they're doing whatever they can to turn that around.
There is no question that that is absolutely a part of a large part of why the Republicans are so determined to try and erase President Obama's legacy as manifested by the Affordable Care Act. But, you know, with here in America, it's one simple axiom that you always, always have to pay attention to is simply follow the money. And the biggest reason that the Republicans want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, you know, also known as Obamacare, is the fact that in order to finance the Affordable Care Act that provided health care to millions of Americans who had been, you know, traditionally either underinsured, uninsured, or uninsurable, was that there was a tax placed on the top 10% of income earners. There's a graduated tax that all Americans earning more than $200,000 a year have to pay to help support and finance the Affordable Care Act. And again, the more money you make, for instance, if you make like the current occupant of the White House, you know, $100 million a year, you pay a substantially higher portion of taxes. And the bottom line is that if the Republicans are successful in repealing the Affordable Care Act, that is going to translate into a $600 billion tax cut for the top 10% of income earners in the United States. And that is the probably single biggest reason that they are determined to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, it's very interesting to me that while President Obama was in office, all the Republicans had to do was, you know, call it Obamacare or say, hey, look, this is something this black man is trying to do. And a lot of Americans with, you know, racial issues never even stopped to think about what they were considering. They were just against it because, you know, they don't want anything to be administered or mandated by an African-American man. But now that he's out of office, what you're seeing at these town halls is that when these representatives talk to their constituents about repealing the benefits that people have gained in the Affordable Care Act, suddenly they are furious, because once they actually stop to consider what is being offered to them and provided to them via the Affordable Care Act, they like it. They like the fact that they now have insurance that allows them to see doctors on a regular basis without having to, you know, mortgage their home. They like the fact that they can keep their children on their insurance until the kids are out of college. They like the fact they can no longer be kicked off of insurance for having pre-existing conditions or prevented from getting insurance in the first place because of pre-existing conditions. So, you know, President Obama, unfortunately, was a very convenient straw man for the Republican Party, and they're finding that now that he's no longer in office and people are actually considering what is proffered to them through the Affordable Care Act, they really like those benefits and don't want to part with them.
It's a very civilized concept, insurance for everyone.
Yes, go ahead. I was just going to say that it's been particularly horrifying for me to hear some of these Republican representatives literally say things like, you know, healthcare is not a right, and that, you know, good people don't have pre-existing conditions, and that, you know, if you can't afford insurance, then you don't deserve it. I mean, those are just hideous, heinous, you know, inhuman statements, but these are the things that these people truly believe. And, you know, I think the only recourse we have is to vote these horrible, horrible people out of office.
Absolutely. I think it was it Miss USA who also said that recently, that healthcare is a privilege?
Wow.
Now there's an authority. Okay. Anyway, I know that the Affordable Care Act, unfortunately, is different from state to state, and some states have had some really good results with it, and some others haven't. So what have you seen with it in your experience over the last few years?
Well, yeah, and that's, I'm happy to talk about that because, you know, we talked about the kind of medicine I practice, but one thing that we didn't discuss is where I practice our medicine.
Yep.
And ever since I finished residency, I have deliberately chosen to work in clinics that are free clinics for, well, back then, you know, before the Affordable Care Act, was for uninsured patients, and in public hospitals for low-income and underinsured individuals. And there is no question but that since the Affordable Care Act has been in place, people who previously were not able to see, to either have a private physician or see that doctor on a regular basis simply because they couldn't afford to pay for their health care and were therefore forced to wait until they were so sick they had no choice but to come into an emergency room. That a lot of that has changed. We have seen where, you know, a large percentage of poorer populations were presenting with end-stage diseases because of their inability to care for themselves or to obtain care and manage their health issues, that process is being reversed, that now people are able, through the Affordable Care Act, to see a doctor on a regular basis, to keep their medical conditions managed as opposed to allowing them to reach a point where they have no choice but to be carried into an emergency room. And it's significantly improved the overall health profile of the patients that I've seen in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And there's also no question that hospitals, which frequently were operating in the red because they were being forced to treat so many people who couldn't pay them and were therefore in danger of closing, are now on a much firmer financial footing. And so that you have hospitals which otherwise would not be able to remain open being financially solvent and being available to people in areas where they live, as opposed to before, where we were seeing these hospitals closing and people being literally, both figuratively and literally, further from care simply because there was no hospital in their neighborhood or region, simply because those hospitals had closed due to financial difficulties. So it's made a huge difference. And that's why, you know, the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, and physicians across the country have come out decidedly in favor of maintaining the Affordable Care Act and are horrified by this so-called American Health Care Act, which is health care in name only. In fact, it does not provide health care for people. It provides the illusion of health care, because if you listen to the Republicans when they talk about this so-called American Health Care Act, what they say is that it provides access to health care, meaning that theoretically, people will be able to access insurance, but the kinds of premiums and deductibles that they would have to pay means that, practically speaking, they won't have health care. It's sort of like, you know, if I tell someone who's, you know, a homeless person in Bel Air, well, you have access to the homes here. Yeah, but they cost $2 million. They can't afford it. You know, so it's a sick and cruel joke to talk about access to health, to so-called health care, that is completely unaffordable.
Well, I always like to look at the big picture and look at history. And I think all of us in the United States, especially our leaders and our politicians, really need to look history in the face and see what this country was built on. So, you know, just briefly, we started by blasting away a people. We just ran over the Native American Indians and took over. Okay, not a very pretty thing.
Well, and in many cases committed deliberate genocide so that we could take over their land. Yeah, I mean, this was not a benign or sort of process that occurred by second intention. I mean, you know, our government did things like deliver smallpox-infected blankets to Indian tribes with the deliberate goal of wiping them out so that their lands would then become available for European settlers. Yeah, so.
So I want to have a certain amount of pride in this country, and I've learned I have a wonderful life and a lot of opportunity. I know that that's not true of everyone, but the history is not pretty. And of course, then we had slaves in this country, and I believe we still do have slaves in this country. Some of them have come in from other countries illegally that are working in pockets that we don't aware about. And then many people are working for such small wages that they're practically slaves.
That is so true. And I also think that we have, to some extent, exported our slavery because we have manufacturing being done in countries where people are virtual slaves and are working for in such onerous conditions and for such meager sums that they are effectively wage slaves. And, you know, and while, you know, we may not personally, quote unquote, own those slaves, we certainly benefit from their abuse and maltreatment by going out and buying the sneakers and handbags and clothes manufactured by these people.
You know, until we realize that when we make life better for everyone with opportunities and a baseline of simple rights, food and health care and a place to live and access to education, that's going to elevate everyone's lives. And when we take these rights and opportunities and benefits and handouts, as some people may call them, we're only asking for more crime, more hate, more violence. And
that is so true. Yes. And, and the other thing that people, you know, don't, and this is the part that just has never ceased to amaze me, is that somehow we look at the corporate giveaways that we give, you know, wealthy Americans and wealthy corporations as somehow they're right. But when, you know, low-income individuals ask for, you know, a similar consideration, it somehow seemed to be an inappropriate request or, you know, as a welfare. But it's, you know, we allow corporations to write off taxes and get, you know, money from the government in the form of tax breaks for, you know, a variety of you know, behaviors. You know, farmers can get government subsidies for raising certain crops or for even not using their land to raise crops, but somehow that's seen as being appropriate. Yet when a mother with, you know, two children needs help in the form of food stamps, that's considered to be, you know, something that's just, you know, wrong or a sign of poor character. And it's really twisted the way we tend to look at things. I often point out to people that if you look at the time period in this nation when our population had the highest general level of a standard of living and the greatest social mobility in terms of, you know, going to college, obtaining higher education, finding good paying jobs that allowed you to take care of your children and buy a home, it was a period of time when we had a very different corporate and individual tax structure. You know, everyone paid a somewhat larger percentage of their income in taxes, but the general benefit to society as a whole was much greater. And since the 1980s, when Reagan and his myth of trickle-down economics took hold, the general standard of living for most Americans has markedly declined. And whereas the top, you know, 10% of Americans has their wealth has accumulated to a monstrous degree, but in general, most Americans are doing much worse. And it's a simple matter of you get what you pay for. If we don't pay for anything, but allow instead, you know, a few individuals to accumulate obscene amounts of wealth, we all suffer as a consequence, except for the very wealthy.
Well, I'd like to think that if everybody was eating a plant-based diet, we'd get a lot smarter and we could make better decisions. But I don't think that that's the only thing that's going to do it, unfortunately.
No, but it would go a long way towards helping, because for one thing, it would change the complexion of our general health, as opposed to spending trillions of dollars every year on what are, without question, preventable health care issues. We would have a lot more money to spend on helping people to remain healthy instead of struggling to try and retrieve their health once it's lost.
I've been using an app called ResistBot lately. I don't know if you've heard about it.
No, I haven't.
It's on my phone, ResistBot. I recommend people look it up. It makes it very easy to send letters to your senators and representatives in Congress. And I've been sending one or two a day. I'm like going nutty. And what they do is they type up your thing in a letter and fax it. And you can even add your signature to it. So it looks really like a real letter, because it is, but it's so much easier to do. Anyway, I bring it up because in talking about insurance and the cost of healthcare, if we only talked about educating people to eat healthier, and if we only changed the balance of food production so that healthy plant foods were the least expensive options and made them more accessible, we could dramatically reduce the cost of healthcare, and this insurance debacle wouldn't be the mess that it is.
That is absolutely 100% true. There's no question that that's true.
So everybody write your representatives and say we need to be talking about plant-based diets to bring healthcare costs down.
Whew. Absolutely. And I would say at the end of each letter, just make a note. I'm paying attention to how you vote, and please keep in mind that I also vote. And if I don't like your votes, I'm going to vote against you in the next election.
That
is one thing that these representatives do pay attention to, because the fact is, the only way they can keep their jobs is if they keep getting reelected. And if they know that people are actually paying attention to the way that they vote and will punish them if they don't vote properly, that is the only way we're going to change our government.
Exactly. Well, you know, it all comes down to capitalism, unfortunately. And my hope for the future is to find a better system than capitalism, because capitalism isn't working.
Well, I would agree with you. And one of the fundamental problems is that it's built on a fundamental impulse is selfishness.
It's built on exploitation, Milton.
Right, exactly. And it's
exploitation.
And it's often seen as a zero-sum game. In that, you know, I can't advance if I don't take something from you. And that's really sad and unfortunate.
Yes. Okay. One last thing. I want to end on a happy, delicious note. So have you had anything interesting, yummy in the vegan world lately in your travels?
Oh, my goodness. There's a new vegan chain called New Vegan, NU Vegan. That has two outlets here in the D.C. metro area. One is in College Park in Maryland near the University of Maryland College. And then there's another branch that's in Washington, D.C. on Georgia Avenue. And the food there is just absolutely amazing. And I've been taking some samples of their food to work to share with my colleagues who absolutely love it. And, you know, whereas before they thought vegan food simply because they hadn't experienced it, were concerned that, oh, I'm not going to like it, or, you know, this is something strange. They realized, my goodness, the food is delicious. It's satisfying. And it's actually good for me. And they realized, you know what? I can be more plant-based if I choose to. And so that's a very positive thing.
That's fantastic. Dr. Milton Mills, thank you so much for this time. I love you and love talking to you, and I look forward to reading more of your rants on Facebook.
Well, then there will be more.
Yes, unfortunately. Okay, be well. Thank you for joining me, and it's all about food.
My pleasure, Karen. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Whew, that was Dr. Milton Mills. Isn't he awesome? I think so. Fantastic. Okay. Couple of things I wanted to bring up before we move on. There's something happening in New York for all of you New Yorkers who are listening, and for those who aren't in New York and are listening, you should be interested too, because apparently there is a plan to release genetically modified moths in New York, and this can have tremendous environmental impacts. We don't even know what the impacts are on animal and human health and the environment, and you can find out more about this by going to gmwatch.org, and they have some links where you can make comments to the USDA. I made my comment today, not in favor of releasing these moths, because clearly they haven't done enough testing to know anything about if it's safe, and the problem isn't even that big of a problem. So the thing is that the comments are necessary by May 19th, 3 days. So I hope you go to gmwatch.org, read this article on these diamondback moths, genetically modified version of them. And if you agree with me or not, please post your comments on the USDA site. We all need to get loud and louder. All right. Thank you for that. All right. Back to the show. It's all about food. And my next guest, Ted Genoese, is an award-winning writer and editor. He is a contributor for the New Republic and reporter for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. In addition to The Chain, which is a book we talked about a few years ago on this show, he is the author of two books, of poems and the nonfiction book Walt Whitman and the Civil War, named a Best Academic Title of 2010 by the American Library Association. He is under contract with Norton for two new books, The Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Farm, and Tequila Wars, The Bloody Struggle for the Spirit of Mexico. Genoese is a contributing writer at Mother Jones, The New Republic, and On Earth. His essays and poetry have also appeared in The Atlantic, Bloomberg, Business Week, Harper's, The New York Times, Outside, and The Washington Post Book World. He is a winner of a National Press Club Award and the James Arison Award for Social Justice Journalism. He has received fellowships from the NEA and Guggenheim Foundation. He just wrote a fantastic report. I read it yesterday, and wow, am I lucky to be able to talk to him about it today. Welcome to It's All About Food. Ted, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. That's quite an introduction.
Yeah, well, you are quite somebody. Thank you for all your hard work.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm glad to be here to talk about it.
I remember your book, The Chain. We talked about it a few years ago, and I wish these kind of books were required reading for everyone to realize how so many different things that we think we have clear opinions on are connected, and we don't have a clue how things became what they became.
Well, and that was really the whole concept behind The Chain in the first place, to look at, with that book, the way in which the supply chain is affected whenever there's any kind of change in that case, production speed. And as soon as a company starts saying, we need to produce faster, it has implications for the worker safety, for food safety, for environmental issues and animal welfare. And as you say, these issues are all interconnected, and we tend to tackle them as independent problems, but very often the solutions that we're trying to find to these problems in isolation are actually working against each other.
Now, that particular book focused on the company Hormel, the makers of everyone's favorite product, Spam.
That's right.
And so it's all about food, as I like to say. And it was a very fascinating read and very upsetting. And I don't know that many things have changed since you've written that book. And that took place in two states, Nebraska and was it?
And Minnesota.
Missouri?
Yeah, it was also set in Minnesota. And
Minnesota.
I mean, the thing that's sort of interesting, I would say that the thing that was starting to change as I was finishing the writing of that book was not anything in terms of the conditions within the meatpacking plants or the supply chain that that make those plants possible. It was the biggest change was in the demographics of the workforce, and as the industry was starting to look for a workforce that was similar to the undocumented workforce that they had been relying on for close to 20 years, in terms of language barriers and disconnectedness from the community and that sort of thing, but not being subject to immigration and customs enforcement raids, the industry at that time was just starting to turn toward refugee labor. And that was most visible in the Hormel supply chain with the addition of Karen workers from Burma. But there was also just starting at that time to be some influx of Somali workers who are now a huge part of the workforce in poultry and beef.
Right. And that brings us to your article. The title of it, could you tell me the title of it? I don't have it in front of me, and I don't want to say it incorrectly.
Sure. The title, I think it's important to note that the title is in quotation marks. It's something that is taken from one of the people in the story, that the title is "The Only Good Muslim is a Dead Muslim," which is spoken on FBI wiretaps by one of a group of men from Southwest Kansas who had decided that they would undertake a kind of Timothy McVeigh-style bombing of an apartment complex in Garden City, Kansas, that is filled with refugee meatpacking workers from a nearby Tyson packing plant.
This is an American story, Ted.
Well, it is. I mean, on a number of levels. I mean, the immigration story, the story of new people arriving in this country and trying to make a better life for themselves. The meatpacking industry has almost always been that bottom rung of the ladder, and that's been the case really since the meatpacking industry was industrialized and sort of the era of Upton Sinclair. You know, at that time when Sinclair was visiting the stockyards in Chicago and going to the Swift beef packing plant, it was, you know, primarily filled with Jews who were fleeing the pogroms in Eastern Europe and Russia, Greeks who were coming from the Mediterranean, you know, a very different kind of demographic, but a similar story. And these were people who were fleeing violence, who were fleeing oppression, and who were coming to the United States hoping for a better life. And we still see today that's what drives a lot of refugee migration. And yet the obstacles that were faced by the immigrants in the time of Upton Sinclair are still the same obstacles that refugees face now. Discrimination in terms of housing, difficulty being able to unionize and improve work conditions in the packing plants, and obviously discrimination then as well from the community, from people who feel that they're displacing them from jobs or are depressing the pay that the workers may be able to command, and it creates friction within the communities. And it's been that way for at least 100 years.
So can we say it's better, worse, the same? Don't know.
I mean, I think it's, I don't think it's better, I'm sorry to say, but, and I think that the chief way that it is worse is that there's a moment right now where a lot of the fears and suspicions that surround refugees and have always surrounded refugee groups, suspicions about their culture, their religions, their ways of eating. Food is almost always a point of conflict and discrimination. Those rumors and misconceptions now are spread very rapidly on social media. And there's a way of things that once were whispers now get magnified by the megaphone of social media, and people who have shared fears are better able to find each other. And I think it has an effect of magnifying those misconceptions. And rather than people being forced to interact with each other and to find points of contact, it's a little bit easier to retreat into the echo chambers that we've created for ourselves.
The polarization is getting greater.
I think that everything. It is. I mean, one of the things that stunned me in the reporting of this story, the men who planned this bombing were arguing to the FBI undercover agents who they were in contact with, who they believed were members of a criminal syndicate who could help them construct the bombs that they wanted to detonate. They were repeatedly telling them that they believed that the Somalis were not only, displacing people from jobs and Muslims and all of the sorts of fears that go with economic insecurity and religious insecurity, but there was a lot of conversation, and repeated in their Facebook feeds in particular, about the belief that their corner of Kansas, this remote area where the largest town of any size in that whole part of the state is 25,000 people, that it was poised to be overtaken by UN troops should Donald Trump win the general election, and that Obama was going to declare martial law. Those UN troops would roll in and their UN tanks, overtaking the towns and closing the roads, and that Somali immigrants would be bussed into every town to take over and control the communities. And it's utterly absurd and delusional. I mean, if you think even for a moment what kind of occupying force, the sheer size of an army you'd have, that it would be able to overtake every small town in every part of America. But what it shows is that one of the things that has happened with social media and with all kinds of media being present in our lives at all times is that the international and national news seem to be playing out on the local level. And when we see this conversation about the dangers of immigrants, the dangers of terrorism, our perception is not that those things are very far away, because they're taking place in our living rooms. They're repeated on our Facebook discussions and are on our phones with us at all times. And so I think people have this perception of these things being very present. And that sort of distortion makes the concerns that everyone, I think, in the media already has about fake news stories and about disinformation sites that are intentionally trying to mislead people. I think it's that this campaign has been so successful in the last few years because the dissemination devices are with us at all times. And as such, those who have fears and would seek to be violent are able to self-radicalize 24 hours a day at any time, anywhere.
We've got plenty of data and research for those who are interested in looking for it that show that immigrants benefit our society, that immigrants who come in legally and illegally are good workers and help improve the economy and sometimes do the work that other people don't want to do. And we've also seen that the terrorism that has occurred in this country has been performed by citizens of this country who were born here and not by these immigrants that people are so afraid of. But you mention in your article the Somalis joined earlier waves of Cambodian, Vietnamese, Burmese, and Hispanic refugees. The difference is that the Somalis are Muslim?
Well, I think it's partly that. I think it's partly that the religion and partly, I don't think that it can be underestimated that that they're not only Muslims, but they're black Muslims. And, you know, the wave of Somali immigrants coming into Garden City really started in 2006. And so it was not too long after September 11th, and it was not long after a whole program of immigration raids that had been undertaken by the Bush administration. And so there was a strong anti-immigrant sentiment at the time, and certainly a strong anti-Muslim sentiment, exactly at the moment that that this population was arriving in a place that was at that time over 90% white as well, looking at least across the demographics of that whole corner of the state. What's interesting about a place like Garden City is that, as you say, it was a wave of immigration that was building on previous waves. And so there had been Vietnamese and Cambodian refugees who had been some of the first workers in the meatpacking plants in that area after the authorization of additional refugees being brought into the country in 1980. That wave was followed by Hispanic workers, both legal and illegal, coming out of Latin America and Cuba, as well as Guatemala and Mexico. And so, in some ways, there were some people in the community, I think, who were sort of acclimated to the changes that were happening in the community and seeing at a civic level how the immigrants were bolstering the town's population and allowing businesses to thrive. But there were also other people who were looking at these waves of immigration building on each other and were seeing the white percentage of the community start to dwindle. And eventually their sense was that that they were, I guess some would say, losing their culture. I think others might say losing their kind of inherent supremacy in a community like that.
Absolutely. It's happening everywhere. So the last piece of this is that the story centers around a meat packing town, a meat packing industry. And I'm a vegan. I think factory farming is probably one of the worst creations humanity has ever come up with. And we were just talking to Dr. Mills, medical doctor, about how plant-based diets are really the ideal diet for humans. And our healthcare costs are soaring because people have heart disease and diabetes, which are preventable and reversible. People's health today in general, it's terrible because of our diets. I would like to see all of this just go away. Completely start some new industries, help these people get involved in growing organic food and doing things that are better for the environment. It's, you know, I can dream, can't I?
Well, certainly the beef industry is incredibly entrenched. But I think it's also worth noting in these sorts of things that the beef industry as it exists now is a relatively new creation. It was not so long ago that the way we raised cattle was by raising them on rangeland, was raising them such that they were grazed rather than being brought into feedlots and corn-fed and given other types of feed. That change has radically reshaped the food system, and it's radically reshaped the American diet. And I think that anyone, regardless of whether you're a meat eater or a vegetarian or a vegan, I think you'd have a hard time arguing that it's been good for our health. Certainly the obesity epidemic is on full display and has been in many ways driven by industries connected to the beef industry, fast food in particular. And it's also become an increasing public health problem in terms of what we're finding about antibiotic resistance and other sorts of public health impacts coming from feedlots and other kinds of animal confinements. And last but not least, obviously, the environmental impacts. And at a moment when we're trying to figure out ways to reduce environmental impact and our environmental footprint, I do think it is important to bear in mind that the burgeoning of the beef industry, and then particularly feeding beef what we have been in the forms of corn and other grain feeds, has been really problematic. And it makes sense at a moment when it's still possible to be thinking about ways of improving, at the very least, that food system. It's not a sustainable food system,
No.
Given that, it only makes sense to change it in some way or another. It may be, I think the prospect, at least at the present, of the American people as a whole going over to vegan diets seems remote. But I would also say that there are changes happening all the time, and I think, you know, it makes sense to me in whether we're talking about things like forms of new energy or talking about ways of changing the food system to always be pushing toward whatever we consider to be the ideal and not merely some incremental change. We might as well go for what we really would like to see in the world.
Well, I want to sum this up kind of like I summed up the first part of this program. What I think isn't sustainable is capitalism as we know it. It's based on exploitation. And in your story, there's so much exploitation going on. Even the original townspeople, well, there's no original townspeople there, but the people that were there before the Somalis and the other immigrants that were brought in, even they have been exploited to some extent. The industry exploits everyone. We're trying to squeeze whatever we can out of everyone that we can, people and animals, the environment, so that we can sell things for the lowest cost and make the greatest gain. And that's not sustainable.
It's really not. And it's true that everything in the industry is built on a model of sort of infinite growth. And while that has been, you know, remarkably sustained for a period of almost 50 years in the case of the beef industry, in the form of additional irrigation for feed crops and bringing cattle into ever larger feedlots and finding new industrialized methods and finding workforces that are cheaper and willing to work under more difficult circumstances. It has really reached a point that is a kind of unbreakable limit. As you say, the land can only sustain so much. It's only possible to push the animals to certain physical limits. And even with the mechanization and some of those changes that have happened on the packing line, you can only push people so far. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with you that it seems to me that at a point before the system utterly ruptures and we have a total crisis on our hands, I think it only makes sense to be looking for ways to repair the system and turn it in a new direction.
Ted, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. We're at the end of the hour. And I want to direct everyone to newrepublic.com. You can read this article that was posted yesterday, May 15, 2017. The only good Muslim is a dead Muslim. That's in quotes. I didn't mean that. Quote, the only good Muslim is a dead Muslim. A meatpacking town in Kansas opened its doors to Somali refugees. Then a group of Trump supporters plotted to kill them after Election Day. Please read it. Share it. It's important. Ted, again, thank you for your work. I really appreciate what you're doing, and I look forward to whatever you're going to write next.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the chance to talk to you about all of this.
Okay. Thank you for joining me. Well, we've come to the end, haven't we? Yes, we have. Whew, I enjoyed it. I hope you did. If you have any comments and questions, you can reach me at info@realmeals.org. Visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Please read my blog, What Vegans Eat. If you're struggling with moving to a more plant-based diet or eating vegan, you can see what a couple of vegans eat every day. It's all there with recipes. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.